All right. Well, good afternoon and welcome. It's nice to see so many people in the room. We're going to get started. Again, just a reminder to put your phones on silence, if you would. And I'm going to invite the speakers to join me on stage. So again, welcome. Really excited that you guys are here with us this afternoon. My name is Colleen Pritchett, and I lead one of our electronic businesses at Dow DuPont. Today, I'm happy to be your MC for the next hour. And I'm thrilled to be here in support of the advancement of women, leaders across our state and throughout our community. I've worked at DuPont for about 22 years, and I've led teams both domestically as well as internationally, living in Asia. I've felt very strong support throughout my career through training and development, as well as connections with our strong women's global networks, in addition to coaching and mentoring women across the globe. As both DuPont and Dow have done for many years, but now as a combined company, we are a proud sponsor of this year's Pennsylvania Conference for Women. And we're looking for great women to join our team. The Conference for Women offers a blend of practical tools and advice, inspiration, which I'm sure you've felt today, and a lot of great networking throughout the day and hopefully beyond. I want to thank you for participating in today's session of the Corner Office Success, How to Accelerate Your Career Trajectory. And this is an encore session. They had one very similar to this earlier in the day. And we have an amazing hour in store for you. At this time, I'm really excited to introduce Shoma Chatterjee, who heads the leadership development and coaching practice of GH Smart, an executive advisory firm. Shoma advises executives in a variety of areas, such as asset management, financial services, and private equity firms, on scaling their leadership impact as they take on bigger and broader roles. One area of her research is leadership acceleration for senior women leaders. Shoma has earned many degrees, a BA from Northwestern University, an MBA from Columbia Business School, as well as an MA in International Affairs from Columbia University. She's based in New York, is a certified executive coach, and a founding fellow at the Institute of Coaching at Harvard Medical and McLean Hospital. So please put your hands together for a very warm welcome to Shoma.
Thank you, and incredible women and Renaissance men, thanks for coming. I'd like to do the following. I'll take about 5 minutes to summarize some of the research that we did along this project called the CEO Genome, essentially tracking 18,000 candidates for CEO positions over the last 20, CEO and C-suite positions over the last 20 years, figuring out who they are, you know, how they got there, and what they did differently. So just 5 minutes on that, because I'm joined by a legendary panel, women who have created their own path in very big corporations, universities. So Naomi, on my right, Naomi Mulgrave, is a change agent. She is on the cutting edge of leading large-scale change initiatives, currently at Prudential, was at Amex, so I call her the woman who teaches elephants to dance. So we'll hear about, you know, how she does that. Denise is a legend, one of the most innovative and visible, incredible mentor. She's currently the chief marketing officer at Comcast, but within the media industries, you know, if you just look her up, you know, just I watch clips of her to get inspired. So. And then, of course, Val, who is president of Swarthmore College, and before that, she was a dean of the College of Arts, the undergraduate college at Princeton. And I have so many questions, and so. And I love that you're wearing comfortable shoes. Right on.
She's been here before.
Exactly. At the big conference.
I didn't have a chance to change, and I just decided,
Great.
It's perfect. So thank you all. So just to summarize the research we've done and how we got there. So as Colleen mentioned, we are an executive assessment and coaching firm. We've been around for about 20 years, and what we do is, you know, firms, private equity, or Fortune 500 would bring us in, and nonprofits, would bring us in when they have their final, you know, two or three candidates for C-suite roles. And we would do these extensive, we still do, five-hour assessments of them, every chapter of their life, every chapter of their career, what did you do, how did you do it, just to study patterns. And then we narrow that down and follow them around and stalk them for months to see kind of like gorillas in the wild, executives in the wild, and what they do. So, you know, after we had 18,000 of these assessments, a lot of professors from universities, namely Professor Stephen Kaplan from University of Chicago came to us and said, you guys should do something with this data. We live in an era of people analytics. And so our firm, incidentally, is 51% women. So we said, oh, let's see if our perceptions of the C-suite meshes with, you know, a reality in the data. So what were our perceptions? You know, square-jawed, tall men, think Mitt Romney, 6'4", Ivy educated, flawless careers until maybe you run for the presidency, but really, you know, just that kind of trajectory. And then after we did the research, the first thing we did was we debunked a lot of these myths. The first is, you know, 45% of our, you know, sample had a big, at least one big career blow up in their lives. They learned to recover and they learned to sort of bounce back and frame that failure, but at least one, most of them have two. So, you know, I got a lot of energy and passion from that because I've got many, many failures. The second is only 7% went to these Ivy League schools. In fact, you know, just as many or even more never went to college, which was also very inspiring to me. The third is 33% self-identified as introverts. So, you know, and once they get to that C-suite position, introverts did just as well, in fact, slightly better than, you know, people who are non-introverts or extroverts. So a lot of data, and, you know, the next question we asked was, well, what? How did they get there? Because on average, it takes 24 years from the time you start working to the time you get to the C-suite. So how do you speed that up? And that's essentially, you know, the topic of our panel, career catapults. What can you do to sort of accelerate that path? So three things came up in the research. The first is you go big. You take a big leap. You know you're not going to be ready, but somehow you got rid of the gremlins on your shoulder, the naysayers, and just took the leap. The second thing you do is go small to go big, or zig to zag, as some people say. Take a different kind of role so it adds to what you didn't previously have, like Matt being a GM for a country, sort of a country for your company or a region, or, you know, starting a new product, or just going off and doing a startup outside the company. So that's the go small to go big lever that people pulled. And then the third is go clean up. And, you know, clean up as in you inherited a mess or you dove into a mess. And that's the most scarce sort of attribute in company. So if you have that, you know, brand in you, you know, you should be writing your check to the top without a problem. So, you know, most of them were turnaround situations or lagging bottom line situations, but a lot of them in our data sets had, you know, either failed technology implementations, ERP and SAP, stuff that didn't work well, and then somebody came in and cleaned it up and got it back on. So if you spot some of those, you know, see if the opportunity is appealing to you. So, and then how did they do it? Because there's two parts of the equation, and you already know this having been here all day, right? So one is get results, and the second is get known. And not surprisingly, women are fantastic at the first, and not so great at the second. So how do you get known without, you know, tuning your own horn or in a way that's authentic? But you got to get known, be seen and be heard, as we just heard from Serena Williams. So I'm going to turn to understand how these women did it. So we talked about the who and the what and how these women did it. And I want to stop now because I'm having a fangirl moment, and I just want to get to them as soon as I can. So before we get into all of them, I just wanted to ask you, Val, how do you size up the career risk that you decide to take? Do you just say yes? Because I've been told that, you know, you've got to think about whether the conditions for your success are there and the career proposition being offered to you. Others tell me, just say yes, man. Just get on the seat, lean in. So how have you done it? Like lately, your recent chapter, President of Swarthmore.
Okay, thank you for that question. I think I've done a combination of things. And one of the questions that comes to my mind is, how different is it to rise to leadership positions in academia,
yeah,
as opposed to in business?
Yeah. I
would say that the decision that I made to accept the offer to be president at Swarthmore was a very difficult one.
Mm-hmm.
I had a job that I quite enjoyed and that felt comfortable,
yeah,
and I knew that I was tempted by the possibility of becoming president of Swarthmore. It did feel like a big leap,
mm-hmm,
and it was scary. But I think some of the advice that I've given other people came back to me, and I decided, and I think to some degree that was what prompted me to go ahead and give this a shot. And that is that that I think it's so important to trust yourself to walk toward opportunities that are scary,
hmm,
as opposed to walking,
yeah,
away from them,
yeah,
and that great opportunities often come from great situations that seem to present great,
yes,
risk. I recently read a book review that referenced a quotation by the psychologist Ellen Langer, who said, "You don't something to the effect of you don't make don't worry about making the right decision." Make any decision the right one.
Yes.
And I think that once you take the pressure off of the decision point and you know that you retain agency,
yes,
whichever decision you go, I find that to,
yeah,
be extremely liberating.
Yeah.
So I think at some level that was working under the surface for me as well.
Do you have a mental model that you, any of you really, that when making these big decisions, just to manage the risk a little bit?
Well, I don't know that it's for me. I'm not sure it's a mental model.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I do lots of pros and cons,
yes,
lists. So I knew that I was not, you know, sort of jumping off the deep end entirely.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think it felt to me that it was sort of an emotional,
yeah,
read.
Yeah.
It felt at some deep level, I felt that I had what it would take, even though I didn't actually know what those tools would be.
Terrific. Thank you. And I love the decisiveness. When we did the study of C-suite folks that actually are the highest performers, four behaviors come to mind. The first one is decisiveness, almost more than being right. Clearly, you can't be wrong all the time. That just,
mm-hmm,
wouldn't work. But, you know, decisive leaders are 12 times more effective or deliver higher performance than those that aren't. The second, just if you're curious, is reliable, execution-focused leaders. That's 15 times, you know, in terms of 15 times more likely to have high performance at the C level. The third and the fourth are adapt and engage, which, you know, I won't go into, you kind of know what they are, but if you're interested in taking this survey to see how you fall across those four behaviors, go to ceogenome.com and see where you shake out. With that, I would love to learn negotiation tips and hacks from you, because you are a deaf negotiator. You're in an easy peasy world of media and telecom. It's so easy to, you know.
Well, I think there are folks I know in the audience that I work with that are probably better negotiators than I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you it's something I've worked on in my career, because I think for women, we're not always aware of our value, you know, and we have a tendency to undervalue ourselves, undervalue our contribution, the role we play in an organization. So I think the basis of any negotiation is to really do your research and kind of understand what is my value, what are positions like mine really worth from a salary perspective, and that data is out there and available for you to know and consume. Yeah. And then I think the other thing is, you know, as I've looked at roles, and I loved Val's answer of how she thought how the president of Swarthmore College was a big risk. Yeah. You know, I haven't done anything quite that. I'm not over analytical about that. In fact, I just say, you know, if it looks better, if it looks more interesting, if it looks challenging, if it looks like something I haven't done before that I think I've got, you know, sort of transportable skills into, I'll take it on, especially if it's working for someone who I think I can learn something from. Yeah. I've learned something fantastic from everyone I've worked for. And so that's really been the criteria. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But even as I've changed those roles, and I would encourage, you know, the women in the audience that may be, you know, younger in their career, don't be afraid to take those new roles, even if they're a lateral, because you will learn so much. Earlier in my career at AT&T, I was in the leadership development program, and you got rotated into a different role outside of your area of expertise every 18 months. And although that was scary, it taught me that I was an athlete and that I could move from job to job, and the things that made me good at one job, you know, would serve me as I moved to another one. I think the other thing with negotiation is really understanding who you're negotiating with and what their history is and what they want. I also believe in there's a way of coming to, you know, negotiation terms so that both parties are very happy. You know, some people have said when both parties are sort of a little bit uncomfortable and hurt a little bit, you're in the right place. Yeah. I don't know if that's true so much as I know I always think about my point of indifference. Have you guys heard about that? Professional negotiation point of indifference. Your point of indifference is really where you say, at what point am I okay walking away? Mm-hmm. In other words, I know that this is my minimum threshold. Anything below that, I just walk away. And I really keep a sort of non-emotional view of what is my point of indifference at a certain negotiation.
Denise, on that note, the research says that women are actually incredible negotiators on behalf of their firms or on behalf of other people, but when it comes to their own careers and making the ask, not so much. What's an example of, have you made the ask? What was an example of you just sort of raising your hand?
You know what, I think others on the panel may have better examples, but here's what I would say. I have never proactively asked for a raise in my career. And I know a lot of women that have and have done that successfully. And I say, if you believe you're being underpaid and undervalued for what you do, you should talk to your boss and you should have that conversation. I just happen to be sort of in the right company and the right place. And I feel like, you know, the decisions made about myself and my career were very generous. And I didn't feel the need to try to make them better. Now, when it came to negotiating, if I was moving, you bet I'm a great negotiator on a move, because I know that when you move a lot for your career, you really know what you need and what your minimums are. But you know, my advice is, you know, don't be afraid to have that conversation. Just again, do your research, understand your value. Understand your perception in the organization. You know, we were in a session this morning talking about personal brand.
Yes.
And, you know, the speaker was saying she's coming out with a personal branding diagnostic. And I said, oh, I can't wait till you come out with that. That's going to be so great. Because you should also know how you're perceived, right? So you don't have any blind spots going into a negotiation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Naomi. Two things, really. One, how do you teach elephants to dance? And two, you know, all of you are so confident, but I've watched you from a distance, you know, for years, and how do you get rid of those gremlins on your shoulder and the imposter syndrome? Like, should I really be speaking on this panel with these women? And should I really? It's interesting, in the speaker lounge, a number of women were doing the power pose, and it was a real communal moment. It's like everyone goes through that. So how have you been able to conquer them and take these big roles, big change leader kind of roles in the digital space?
These are great questions. So the first thing that I would tell you is kind of understand the state of play in an organization when you first arrive. Hmm. So if you don't understand the state of play, then it's really hard to understand what does innovation look like for that organization. Mm-hmm. Understand the external factors. So what would make differentiated value? Understand the consumer needs. And think about what are the relationships that you need to build in order to influence the outcome. Mm-hmm. Very often, it's not about your idea. It's about how you position facts, how you ask the right questions, how those questions influence the ideas in the room, but more than that, how you bring diverse perspectives to the table in order to innovate. Yeah. Innovation doesn't come from one individual saying this is what we must do. It's the multiple factors of individuals around the table that come and they say, you know what, I kind of feel that problem all the time. You know, I'm a mother and I look at it from this perspective. Or perhaps you're a male, and a male looks at it from a totally different perspective. Or perhaps you come from another country, and the consideration factors that you have might be very different. I talk to all stakeholders, and I influence all of those stakeholders to come together. Uh-huh. Functional teams, such as technology teams, they need a seat at the table. They need to understand the application of the consumer need and the solutions you're trying to bring to market. Uh-huh. So bringing these cross-functional and diverse teams together, that's what drives innovation. Mm-hmm. In terms of influencing the elephant at times, it's about having honest dialogue. Hmm. It's about highlighting the case for change and saying, I don't want to talk about why you don't want to do this. I want to talk about the risk of not doing this. Mm-hmm. So being able to sit across the table from a CEO and say, I hear you, and I understand that that feels a little uncomfortable, but if we're going to grow, it will be uncomfortable. Yeah. We're going to do something different. That's uncomfortable. You asked a second question.
Mm-hmm. The gremlins.
And that's the gremlins. What I'll tell you is a gremlin still exists. So the gremlin is still there.
Can't tell. Every now and then. So well done.
Yes. Exactly. The gremlin is still there. But at the same time, you have to change the narrative in your own head. Mm-hmm. When I go into something, the narrative that I have in my head is, what is the outcome I'm looking to drive? What are the key messages that I need to make sure that people receive? And is this anchored in my purpose, the goal that I had for that outcome? And when you do that, no gremlin can stop you, right? Because you're focused on the outcome. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about how do we all rise? How do we get to the outcome of which you're trying to deliver? So gremlins will always exist. The most confident person in the world is not confident. And it's all just smokes and mirrors. But if you can show up and change the narrative and know what you're looking to drive, you'll always be able to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This morning, I heard someone say, if you don't have a mentor or sponsor, it's your problem, not your organization. It just kind of got taken aback. So I'm sure all of you, but the two of you in particular, get asked to be mentors all the time. And what's the right way to do that? Because it feels awkward, and I'm sure being on the receiving end is awkward too. So if you don't have a mentor or a sponsor, what should you be doing in the right way?
You know, you should definitely be networking. And, okay. You know, research proves that if you network outside of your own tribe, your own area, mm-hmm. you're going to be a more creative person. You're going to have better ideas. You're going to be able to drive change. So I think networking and networking purposefully with people who don't necessarily think like you or look like you or are in your industry is always a great thing to develop yourself and to challenge the way that you think. You know, I've had so many mentors through my career. I don't remember any of them that I really asked that they be my mentor. Uh-huh. But when I've done that, I think the key is the value exchange in the relationship. In other words, when you see someone you like and admire, you may not know them. You can ask for an introduction, but you should really put yourself in their heads for a little bit and say, what can I do for them? How can I help them? If I am younger in my career, can I help them understand the perspective of a millennial or a Gen Z coming into the workplace? Can I help them, you know, with something they may be facing, or if I've heard them speak or heard them, you know, see it, you know, read something they wrote, is there something I can help them with? And, you know, I say bringing value to the discussion is key. And then the thing I think that I've observed people do very well and much better than I ever did when I was younger is they'll say, hey, do you mind if we touch base from time to time? Mm-hmm. I would love to check in with you on my career, my progress. Would love to get advice from you, and I would love to help you in any way that you think that I can based on my role and my perspective. And you'll, you know, I know that in my company, Leaders are so willing to do that and willing to take the time to mentor. And it's important to not only gain the other perspective, but it's also important to have someone that at some point when a mentor becomes a sponsor, that's a beautiful place, right? Because now they're really advocating for you and they're advocating for your advancement and for your consideration for roles. Mm-hmm. And that's a great place to be.
Terrific.
I would love to jump in and second a lot of what you said because it really resonates with my own experience and with the experience of so many other people with whom I've worked. First of all, that mentoring relationships are often inadvertent or almost accidental.
Yes.
So I agree with you. I mean, I've had some powerfully influential mentors in my life, and I don't believe I asked them to be my mentors. That flowed from those relationships, that's one. Secondly, that in my experience, mentoring relationships often go in multiple directions. So it's not only that the more senior person has mentored me or that I have mentored people who are less seasoned than I, but that those relationships go both directions, right? And that they are often horizontal. Yeah. So to your point about networking and the importance that that can make. There have been times when I have not had around me people whose careers would be a couple of steps ahead of mine who would be charting a natural path. But I have networks of people all around and we can sort of help each other, give each other valuable feedback and insight and so on. So I think that it's another really important issue. And then the third thing I would say is that I loved the point that you made about the fact that one can find mentors in other industries and other fields. And so I would encourage those of you who are thinking about mentoring relationships to explore the possibility of affiliations you might have in addition to your work relationships that might also offer opportunities for growth and relationships that could feed your insights. So I think about working in volunteer organizations or serving on boards, and those kinds of experiences I think can also expand your networks and help cultivate skills and insights that would be beneficial to you professionally.
And really for all three of you, would love your comments on this. One of the distinctions we saw in the research is that there's a difference between acting and performing. Acting is being somebody else, right? It's not as authentic or trying to be some vision of some iconic whatever. But performing is, you know, tailoring your style so you're still authentic, but you're amplifying certain behaviors, you know, de-emphasizing certain behaviors so you own the room a little bit and you can influence more effectively. I'm interested in your perspectives collectively on, you know, what's the one thing you've had to alter, flex a little bit about yourself as you've ascended the leadership ladder path?
When I think about the many things that I decided to change, and it was a choice, I'll admit to that. I had a very strong Brooklyn accent, so many of you...
You did!
It was very strong, and if you like, I can do it after this session.
Let's talk for coffee.
I know, oh yes. Coffee was such a word for me, I really practiced that. But I had a very strong Brooklyn accent, and one of the things that happened when I started with American Express was that it was not really allowing for me to communicate effectively with the leadership that I needed to influence. Mm-hmm. And so while my thinking was thorough, they said, well, how are you going to influence that? That's distracting from your message. And I took that as, I'm from Brooklyn, what are you talking about? Like, there's nothing wrong with that, right? So that, to me, that was an insult. It was an attack on my character. It was an attack on who I was. Mm-hmm. But I had to take a step back and I had to say, what do I need to change in order to drive and deliver towards the outcome that I need? And the other thing that I had to think about is that no matter where you are, there's a game being played. And you have to understand whether it's Monopoly or Pokemon. So if you're playing Pokemon and everybody else is playing Monopoly, you're in trouble. So understanding your environment and knowing, well, what is it? How do I need to show up in order to show out and get that outcome? I delivered on that change. I took the speech coach. I found a mentor who also had to actually change the way that they spoke. And I loved it. because I was able to influence more strongly throughout the organization. Huh. And by the way, I was able to tell my same story to many other individuals who were in the same position and were being held back from making the progress that they wanted in their career. So I think that authenticity can still be there,
yeah.
But it's very important for you to understand what's holding you back.
Yeah. And Val, you know, academic leadership positions are probably the hardest job, you know, in our research. University presidents, mm-hmm. or even, you know, school heads of schools or networks mm-hmm. of schools. So what have you had to tailor in your style?
It's interesting to me that one of the first observations you made at the beginning of the session was about how many leaders are introverts. Because I think that was, for me, the biggest shift was to figure out how to use the part of me that's an introvert
yeah.
to my benefit as a college president. So that was one reason, I think, why it was so hard for me to make the shift to this role from being a professor and even a dean. It's because that's a career that that actually depends upon one's ability to make use of solitude for preparation for yes. research and writing and all of that. So I had to sort of understand more deeply what introversion means, mm-hmm. right? So introversion fundamentally means that you're the kind of person who gets nourishment from being alone, not that you can't actually right. also be a public right. person. But I realized that I was going to have to make sure that I made space for the personal private time that I need to feed my soul and spirit and life, but that I was going to have to be much more comfortable putting myself out there and figuring out how to be more authentically myself in public situations, whether we're talking about sort of formal presentations or more informal interactions with various constituent groups. It has certainly been a challenge, but I have learned and grown so much from it that I feel fortunate to have had the opportunity to push myself.
Right.
And I think that for me has been one of the big takeaways, is to realize that that this is an example of the value of pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone. Mm-hmm.
Please.
All right, so you gave me time to think about it, so thank you to both of you ladies, my co-panelists. So I think what I would have to say is I had to learn, especially as I worked my way up into a very sort of male-dominated yeah. industry, when and how to use my point of view. Uh-huh. And that's difficult because I have a very strong personality. I'm not necessarily an introvert, I'm an extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I can be I can be the loudest voice in the room if I need to be. And to know when to speak up, when to be a better listener, when to stop interrupting to get my point across, right? And sometimes that's hard when you're in a room full of men who, quite frankly, you know, I mean, the first time I was in a meeting and one of my peers did the hand, you know, and I was like, you just didn't do the hand in my face. You know, but just knowing how to use your point of view in a more persuasive way. Also with more, you know, junior members of my team, to know when to really listen. I may believe I know the answer, but I mm-hmm. owe them my full attention to listen to their point of view. You know, also the more seasoned I get in my career, I think the more I believe I don't know very much at all, and there's so much more I need to know to be mm-hmm. successful. And so I'm better at listening to those other point of views, and that's something that came with time. I wish I had had it much younger in my, you know, when I was earlier in my career, I might have moved up faster, who knows. But I think that's probably it, you know.
A last one, and then we'll open it up to your questions. One of the things that also came up in our research, whether you're male or female, is that the people who have an edge keep their mind and body in fighting shape, and they take good care of themselves. It's not all-nighters, high pressure. It's not the myth of the Silicon Valley CEO, which we know it doesn't work all that well. So what do you guys do to keep your mind and body in fighting shape?
So I surf.
Where? So you surf?
I know, I do. I'm a surfer. I surf in Asbury Park, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
But I learned how to
really?
Surf. And yeah, I know.
That's awesome.
They're not
that's
the nice. Biggest of breaks.
Okay.
Look, I surf safely. I work in insurance. I mean, really.
But risk managed.
Exactly. It's very managed, very manageable. But But I actually travel the world. Uh-huh. So I've traveled to about 45 countries.
Oh, goodness.
And when I travel the world, I travel to learn, to understand the culture. And I'll interview different individuals, so I make sure that it's something that I'm really starting to feed my soul, feeling a little bit more grounded in terms of what are the things that I can make more of an impact on in this life and in this world. I spend a lot of time with charity. I definitely spend a lot of time investing in real estate, so that's one of my favorite hobbies.
Really? Just on your own? That's great.
Yeah, just on my own, just on my own. I've recently invested in a restaurant industry, and I love learning. So when I'm curious about something, I say, well, augmented reality, that's interesting. How can I learn more? So I think the more that you have other experiences outside of work, that kind of forces that drive for balance.
Yeah.
Because you need to spend attention on all of these other things.
Yeah. Belle, your role, you have to be on all the time, because it's not just a job, it's a community ambassador, you know, a face of the world, a faceless world. It's a lot to carry, even on the weekends. So how do you take care of yourself?
Well, I mean, I loved what you said about trying to cultivate other interests. And intellectual curiosity is extremely important to me. And so one of the things that I find so exciting is the fact that I really love meeting new people. My job requires me to spend a lot of time meeting alums and parents and so on, and I really try to find what can I learn from this person, what's going to make this relationship compelling for me and for the college, and so I find that I get a lot of joy from that. I try to keep my mind active by reading across a lot of different areas. I too believe that the taking care of the body is really important. So I love the practice of yoga and Pilates. I like to take lots of long walks when my schedule allows. I prefer to have walking meetings to sitting meetings. I think that it sort of opens up the mind. So, I mean, those are some of the kinds of things. And then basically trying to pay attention to and make time for the relationships that are most important to me as well. I feel that they also keep me grounded.
Yeah.
I can't do all of it all the time, but I try not to get too far from any of those things and throw my life out of balance.
Terrific. One last question for you. A number of, you know, women and men of the millennial generation, young people, you see thousands and tens of thousands of young people every day and have at Princeton and Swarthmore. What kind of skills should women in particular develop earlier on, or women identifying leaders develop earlier on?
Well, I think intellectual curiosity, a willingness to be open to encounters of all kinds, to recognize that opportunities for learning and for growth are around almost every corner, and they are often coming from places that are unexpected. So I think that's one. And then secondly, one of the lessons that we try to share with students more than any other is that our career paths, more often than not, are non-linear, and that you never know what opportunity is going to open up a whole new world. And so it's just so important to be open, gracious, attentive to what's coming next. Because what you think is going to be foreground in your life may actually recede to background, and what you think may be insignificant might actually be a pivot point. And you won't know if you close off opportunities too quickly. So I would say I think that's one.
Thank you. Do you want
to? All right, well, let's give the speakers and panelists a big round of applause. Thank you. Really appreciate all the insights and expertise that we heard, so thank you very much. And we're going to open it up for Q&A. I will point out there's two microphones, one on each side. So if you have a question, I'm going to ask the first question to kick us off here, but if you have a question, please line up behind the microphone, and we'll be happy to open it up to all of your questions. Okay? So let me start. You know, there were a lot of valuable lessons from each of you, and again, really want to thank you. If you could each, Shoma included, so question for our thought leader as well, offer and share maybe 2 to 3 tips for accelerating your career, what would those tips be? And we can start maybe with Shoma. How about you?
Sure. So I think we talked a lot about networks, and it's something I wasn't very good at, and I'm still working on. But, you know, it's important to have three different types of networks. One is operational. So it's the people who help you get your current job done, grease the wheels, teach you stuff, you know, influence, help you influence others. So that's the operational. The second is strategic. These are the people who will stretch you. These are the people who will tell you things that you wouldn't naturally come across, introduce you to people you wouldn't naturally come across, and really sort of a lifeline to, you know, the world out there as you know it. And the third is quite personal. It's psychosocial. It's, you know, a developmental network. It could be family, it could be somebody at work, but some place to go and sort of get the very honest feedback. And I'm a crier, so not be afraid to cry and, you know, have that be a perception out there. So three types of network. You know, I encourage you to take stock of your networks, like who would fall in the operational, who would fall in the strategic, who would fall under developmental or psychosocial, and where you light, you know, how can you build on that?
So I would give you three things. I'd tell you learning agility. Mm-hmm. So continuous learning is very important in order to continue to drive your career forward. The second thing that I would tell you is surround yourself with people who will be extremely honest with you. Mm-hmm. They'll tell you when you didn't do such a great job. They'll tell you when you did a great job, and they'll tell you where to improve. If you don't have those people in your quarter, I call them my front row. So I'm like, my front row, what did you think? And they're very honest with me. Find those people and stick with them. And then the final thing is take risk. If you are not taking risk, then you're not pushing yourself hard enough. If you feel comfortable, then you're not pushing yourself hard enough. And you don't have the people around you to push yourself hard enough. So ask yourself those types of questions, and I think it allows you to accelerate.
Great. Wow, that's great. And two of those were mine too, so I'll give you two more. So the first one is, you know, take the job that no one else, or do the thing that potentially no one else wants to do or doesn't have enthusiasm about it, especially if the organization has a need for it. People who are willing to do that. My very first job was at an ad agency where I begged the owner to hire me, and I said I would empty the trash and mop the floors or do whatever just to get the job. And, you know, I stood out and she hired me. And so that's been one of the mantras in my career. Be willing to do the things that other people aren't willing to do. Second, ask for feedback. You know, as Naomi was saying, you know, feedback is a gift, but sometimes we're afraid of it. We're afraid what it means to us and to our self-perception and what it means to our future. But, you know, feedback is a gift, and it is someone's perception. I always remind myself, perception, it may not be the way your reality, but it's their reality, and you have to, and it, you serve yourself to address it. And that last but not least, leverage your mistakes as a real learning experience. I can tell you that I've made so many mistakes in my career. All of them were recoverable. I ended up in a better place afterwards, but if you use your mistakes as a way to really learn, you know, how to operate differently or what you could have done differently, they are also a gift. Mm-hmm. And I've also had a career blow up. And, you know, I ended up in a much better space than I would have otherwise, although at the time it felt pretty hard to go through it. So those mistakes will serve you.
Mm-hmm.
So don't go last on a panel, because everybody says
great
what you want. So I'm sitting here madly, okay, so there's that. Okay, I do think that, maybe just to build on a couple of other observations, I think first, learning to be an engaged listener is crucially important, and I think that's both in terms of feedback, but also being able to learn from the people on your team, from the people who are coming to you to raise concerns. It's so common for many of us to think we already have the answer when we are in conversations, but I think if we can train ourselves to listen rather than to prepare the answer while people are talking to us, I think that opens up a possibility for learning that can be beneficial to the person with whom we're speaking and to us ourselves. Another thing I would say is that I think it's so important to keep options open. I have had former students who have come to me wondering about what they ought to do next in their careers, and sometimes we'll brainstorm ideas and they'll say, nope, I don't want to do that, nope, I don't want to do, you know. And I sort of sometimes wonder where that certainty comes from, right? Mm-hmm. Fast forward to the point of my career when I was being invited to consider the possibility of applying for deanships. And I remember saying to a colleague, I have no interest in being a dean. And he said, okay, do you have any idea what a dean does? I mean, I think before you, and I thought to myself, that's exactly what I have been saying to my students. So for me, that takeaway is it's so easy to sort of shut out ideas that might actually be the right idea. So give yourself the opportunity to try to learn more before you make precipitous decisions. I think that is another...
That's great advice.
Terrific advice. Now we're going to have a chance to take a risk and practice.
Yes.
You've heard a lot about risk. Ask a question. Make a comment.
Yes, so we'll
throw
start
a grenade.
Over here. We'll take the first question.
Hi, my name is Colleen, and my question pertains to something I think we can all relate to, which is how we present ourselves. You know, I think that unfortunately we still are in a business world where what we wear is, you know, representative of how successful we are in the workplace. And, you know, kind of fortunately gone are the days when you have to wear a uniform of your pantsuit from the 90s and your heels, and now women are expressing themselves more. But I personally have been in a boardroom with all men in their suits and ties, and no matter what I wear, I still kind of feel out of place. So I'm wondering if you have any perspectives on, you know, what C-suite women are wearing today, and, you know, what you would recommend to a young woman to wear who aspires to get there one day.
Wait a second, I still have 90s pantsuits in my closet.
Yeah.
I think nothing wrong with that. Would give the best advice.
So here's what I would say, look around you. So if you look around you and you identify a number of women within your organization that are successful in moving up the ladder, and look at what they're wearing. And then that tells you a little bit more about the climate and the culture of the organization of which you're in. What I would also tell you is think about how you want to show up and what type of climate and culture you want to be part of. Because I do think that when you bring your authentic self to work and when you feel comfortable, you show up with your full energy.
Right.
And you're following that natural GPS. Mm-hmm. You've got to make sure that you find that and you balance that as well.
And just food for thought, if you're in a room full of men and you're worried about what you feel uncomfortable and you think it might be your dress, it could be other things too. I mean, you know, the question you should ask yourself is, why am I not confident in this situation? You know, because, you know, you earned your place there, you belong there. It may not be about your clothes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, we'll go on the other side.
Hi, thank you so much for your comments today. My name is Maisie, and I'm particularly been inspired by your areas where you've learned or had to make a significant change, because that's really impressive, outside the comfort zone. Okay, so my question is you women have been very busy at work, climbing the corporate ladders in academia and corporate America, and I'm wondering if you were given a year with unlimited finances and unlimited time, is there anything that you'd do with that time for purposeful work? And I understand that that's kind of a dreamy thing. Maybe it's something you wish you had pursued a little bit earlier in your career, that you just were so committed to climbing in this one direction and you were so accomplished that you couldn't jump off of that track. I'm looking for not going surfing. I love your surfer. I'm also a surfer. But my question is, we have all these women and some very cool men in the room, and what areas would you love for us to address while you're busy changing the world? Thank you.
You're very welcome. I can start, and we can all kind of pitch in on this. I'll tell you what I think about a lot. I think about how the world is changing and how augmented reality, for example, has a huge implication for how people learn, how we do things differently. And I play that out, and I think about something like an augmented reality ability to get rid of unconscious bias, for example, or how augmented reality can actually change the way that learning is happening in an institution or a university. If I had the opportunity to create another business, it would be something around charitable contributions and leveraging technology in order to really disrupt the way that people think to create a better environment.
Wow.
I've been thinking about that.
You've been thinking about that.
Yeah.
I
want to travel.
You know, I guess I'd add to that. That sounds fabulous. You know, having daughters, and I have a daughter who's a neuroscientist. But you know, she had an aptitude for science early in life, and we love that about her. But I would work on how do I help more young women make the decision to go into career fields, engineering, math, sciences, help them understand that they can do it and that they can be successful, and to help them break glass ceilings in those industries that, quite frankly, are not seeing as much progress as other industries. And I have a heart for that, just because I want to see all of our daughters of the future be able to break through in these areas where historically we haven't had as much traction.
Right. So I can imagine myself wanting to do one of two things. One would be to think about how we can elevate or re-elevate the power of the arts and the humanities to help bridge cultural divides. I think we are at a moment in our cultural history where the arts and humanities have been devalued within academic institutions and in the broader culture, and I think that's at our peril as a society. So I would want to be involved in those kinds of areas. The other thing that I care really passionately about is the future of our democratic process. And so I would want to be involved somehow or other in voters' rights movements and trying to figure out how to engage the young people and those who feel disenfranchised and outside of the process to feel that their voices and their votes matter and to work against voter suppression. So those would be the areas I'd want to be involved in.
You would get our vote.
Please.
Thank you for that question.
Yep.
All right, we probably have time for a couple more questions. Go ahead.
Sure. Hi, my name is Monique. Thank you for being here today. We talked a lot about the importance of mentorship and finding a sponsor and, you know, having a broad network and making sure that you put value and time into that. Realistically, where you sit today and where you've seen your peers in those positions, would you say that you sought those positions out, or it was more based on the network you've built and kind of somebody pushed you to do that?
I'll go first. My boss recruited me for the role. And so I was known for this, for the function he wanted to hire for. And my reputation had caused him to come and talk to me. So I really, really appreciated that. But I think that that's a function of gaining credibility in a certain area that will help you. And, you know, I think an equally important question is, how can I establish credibility in my function? Mm-hmm. And what does that really look like for me? So that, you know, regardless of the role, regardless of who I'm talking to, that I've established at least that minimum required credibility to be considered. And, you know, as I've networked, I've had a few jobs that I applied for and got myself just because I thought they'd be great jobs working for people that I like. But I'm going to say the last five roles I've had, and I've had four at Comcast, they sought me out. And again, the door opened, it looked great, and I stepped through.
So I would agree with that. I do think that reputation at certain points in your career, that's really what starts to propel you forward. The other thing that I would actually tell you is that if you take a step back and you think about where you want to head with your career, you start to figure out where you want to build that reputation. Mm-hmm. And that's what's critically important at various stages of your career as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. About one more question. We'll go ahead.
Hi, my name is Kate. Thank you guys so much for a very valuable panel. I have a quick question about relationships. So you talked about a lot about your network, building relationships. So as a person who, you know, could potentially spur change and speaks up and is a big advocate for progressive ideas in your organization, what are some techniques, or have you ever dealt with influence without authority? And if so, what are some techniques that you've done to deal with that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's usually one of the biggest barriers to driving change. The first thing that I usually do is make sure that I'm giving people information that keeps everyone at the same level of inform. So if we all have a point of view, even if we have a different point of view, at least we're starting with a fact base. So educating individuals around you that would actually influence them to say that the best option for us is this. The second thing that I would say is like building the relationship with the individuals who need to influence the outcome of that decision. So creating that, what I call a relationship map or a stakeholder map, and understanding what are the pressure points. Why would they say no? And sometimes that's not anchored in something that's about business. It might be a little bit more personal or political in some instances. And in those instances, thinking about who around them would actually influence the outcome of which you desire. So it's usually multifactorial, and it's not always a quick win, but if you can get them to move from here to here, so convincing someone to experiment versus convincing someone to go whole hog are two different things. So think about what a win looks like so that you can actually accelerate progress and change.
Great advice.
Yeah, great.
All right, I think we are out of time, but let's give the speakers another round of applause. Thank you. I do want to mention, as you guys are leaving, that the speakers will be signing copies of their books in the exhibit hall right after the session. And please check your app for the next session. So enjoy the rest of the afternoon. Thank you, guys.